Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us today on a super special, awesome edition of the StashMyComics.com podcast. This is our annual edition. What is that, you ask? Well, just like with comic books, annuals only come out once a year. This, our special edition episode, will come out once in a blue moon, only when we got something super cool for you, like we have today with the McFarlane interview. But before we get to that, let me go ahead and introduce the gentleman that sit next to me in virtual reality as far as our recordings go. Jason, the editor of Stash My Comics, how you doing today?
Not bad. How are you?
I'm good. I'm doing good. I watched Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. Is that right?
Yes,
I watched that last night, and I was thoroughly enjoyed with it. I thought it was a really good movie.
I don't disagree. It's a movie you can just kind of shut your brain off and watch.
That's my kind of movie.
Obviously. Like Transformers.
I got to see it in 3D, too, so that was pretty cool.
I'm sorry.
No, I got to see Lincoln swing around his axe and be honest a lot. And to be quite honest, he was a really crappy vampire hunter because he dropped stuff a lot, got beat up a lot.
Now that's not the movie with Daniel Day-Lewis, right?
No.
No.
Oh, okay. I was wondering.
Although, that would might make it really awesome. Tommy Lee Jones out there fighting vampires.
Yeah, that'd be pretty sweet. Yeah. No different than aliens, really.
Yeah.
With that being said, Tom, the master behind Geek Cinema, how are you doing today?
I'm good, sir. You know, you kind of gave it a throwaway that, hey, everyone, McFarlane's on the show. Anyway, let's introduce Jason and Tom. You didn't make a bigger deal out of Tom McFarlane, don't you think?
Well, I think that the interview can speak for itself because Todd definitely does. I had the chance, for those of you that are listening now, I had the great opportunity to sit down with Todd McFarlane over Skype for about an hour. And talk to him about not only the new book that he has coming out, the 400-plus page visual biography about how he started in artwork to where he is today. And let me tell you guys something. It comes out on the 21st. It's called The Devil's in the Details. And the price tag is a little hefty, but it's worth it. $64 for 400 plus pages of Todd McFarlane artwork. Everything from rough pencil sketches to when he was about like in his teens to 20s to when he started inking his own stuff and the concept designs for Spawn and everything else. It is such a good book, and we talked about that a little bit. And we talked a lot about the creation of Image, what story ideas he had left over that he wanted to do with Spider-Man that he never got a chance to. And the scene that he told me was really, really awesome, and I can't wait for you guys to hear that. We also talked about some ideas he had for the new Spawn movie that he wants to write, produce, and direct, so there's a lot about that, and I did some questions from our StashMyComics.com users. Some people were cool enough to put some questions down. I did not get to ask about the Mark McGuire book, though.
Oh, hey, wait, that's all I want to know.
So
home listeners, if you want to hear all that, you got to sit through 30 minutes, much like us, talking about bad X-Men comics.
Yes. No, not bad X-Men comics. Good.
Ooh,
X-Men.
Burn.
But anyways, yeah, it's a great interview, and I think that everybody will like it. It was awesome to talk to him. He was really nice, and he was doing artwork while he was talking to me. So, and he was
hey, cool.
Yeah. He said, "I hope you don't feel cheated." I said, "Todd, I don't feel cheated at all. I got to talk to you." So, that's enough for me. It was nerve-wracking at first. Like,
oh, I'm sure.
It's Todd McFarlane. I mean, you were going to be there, but you were stuck in traffic, and you had the blizzard of 2012 going through New York at the time.
The blizzard of 2012, no one noticed, because it was
the storm of the, you know, century or whatever you want to call it, the week before, we're still kind of picking up pieces from.
Super Storm Sandy.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're glad you're okay, at least. I mean, nothing.
Oh, if I get out. Yeah, no, it's completely fine. Yeah.
But
it's like a tale of two cities here in New York right now. It's the people who weren't touched at all and the people who just decimated. It's bizarre.
I know, and now you got the gas rationing going on.
Yep.
But from what I see, Bloomberg's doing a pretty good job of taking care of it, so.
Yeah, he's pretty good in hard situations. There's something to keep him busy right now. He's not busy banning sodas, so, yeah.
The one picture, the one image that blew me away wasn't so much like the storm surges and all that, because in the battery you guys had the record storm surge of like 14 feet since ever. Yeah. And that was spectacular on its own. But the one picture that really floored me was seeing the subways flood.
Yeah. That, and subway stations, yeah.
Yeah, that's what did it for me. I was like, holy cow. I said that to my wife. I was like, look at that. That's insane. That's never happened ever.
Like pictures of water just flowing out of the battery tunnel. Yeah.
Wow.
And a picture on Twitter of the Statue of Liberty with goggles open out of the ocean behind her. Yeah. That might have been fake.
So many fake pictures floating around. The Independence Day clouds and all that.
Yeah.
But anyways, moving forward, I got to watch The Amazing Spider-Man, finally.
Welcome to the club.
Did you enjoy it? Did you like it?
Okay. This is my train of thought on this. There were things that I liked, and there were things that I didn't. Like, I expected a lot from the movie, and I went away from the movie not disappointed, but not happy either.
Okay.
You know why you expected so much from the movie?
Because I'm a huge fanboy, and I want certain things, and they didn't give them.
It's all Tom's fault.
but I put it in my top 10 list of all time. I'm going to keep it.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean,
well, okay.
I understand. It's a movie. It's just, have an opinion.
This is what I got out of it. The whole chemistry between Garfield and Emma Stone was fantastic. That was one of the best parts of the movie. The blossoming of love between Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy. That was done very well. That was really taken care of and well handled. And I appreciate that. I love how he created the web shooters that showed his intellect, and I love how he kind of put in the attitude a little bit in the beginning, but it kind of dropped away after that. I didn't like that as much, but I was okay with it. My only weakness, small tiny knives, that was cool. What I didn't like, I liked Martin Sheen as Uncle Ben. That was a good choice. He did a really good job. I did not like Sally Field as Aunt May at all. I was not happy with that, nor her performance, period.
Was she not Aunt May-ish enough for you?
She was not. She was not at all. She did not remind me of any sort of Aunt May.
Yeah, no, not even ultimate Aunt May. It was very different, you know. It was just the color of the hair? I don't know. But it's, yeah.
Well, yeah, maybe, but no glasses, no nothing, nothing to make her look older or to feel warm and whatever. She just wasn't it. Dennis Leary as Captain Stacy. There wasn't enough of that. There wasn't enough of that. Like, what he did was good, and it was Dennis Leary good, but there was not enough of Captain Stacy. And the lizard was, he looked cool, but there wasn't enough development of that. It was like it was Dr. Connors. You didn't even know how he lost the arm, and then
okay. Here's my question: the whole scene where he's riding the skateboard, practicing his powers. Did you roll your eyes?
A little bit, yeah, because that's not how it worked. And I did like how they threw the wrestling ring in there. I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
That was a good salute to the past and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It had a big Ultimate Spider-Man feel to it, and that was okay. I was okay with that.
It should be.
Yeah. But overall, I would give that movie a 6.5 out of 10.
Yeah, wait, so you would say 6.5, you said?
6.5. 6.5. Yep.
And you give everything a 9. You give everything a 9.
I know, and I had such high hopes for this. The costume I got over. You know, I didn't like that, and I was very vocal about hating that all the way up to I watched the movie, and I got over that, you know, that obstacle. But,
yeah, well, I mean, look, you guys are allowed to have opinions even when they're wrong, so it's all right.
But they're just, I don't know, it was like a mismatch, it was like a mash of a bunch of stuff, and they glossed over a bunch of stuff, and then Spider-Man's climbing walls, and all of a sudden, C. Thomas Howell is turning cranes so he can go swing while he's wounded, and another thing I didn't like is he took his mask off way too much.
I gotta see the face in the movie.
Yeah, screw that. He already got made to be in the movie. He needs to wear the mask. Spider-Man, don't take it off. Ugh, anyway. So, next we have our podcast in December, and I watch The Dark Knight Rises. We'll talk about that one, too.
Okay.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen.
How friggin' long it is, all right.
Okay, we're going to take a break for a second. When we come back, we're going to hit up some news. We've got Lucasfilm being bought out by Disney. Everybody knows that already. You're going to get our view.
Wait,
maybe
what?
What? You really think
what?
That?
What?
Oh, my. I'm sorry, Tom.
Jeez, you know, hair.
Tom, it would be way more convincing if you didn't already write an article about it.
Well, I'm going to get my time machine now and jump back and write an article. That's how it happened. Take that.
Hopefully, we'll be back by the time we get back from this neat little break. Also, we're going to talk a little bit about the World War Z trailer. Stan Lee confirms Doctor Strange for a movie. And, the best news of all, Mark Wahlberg is official for Transformers 4. We'll be right back.
Stash my comics.
Stash my comics.
Stash my comics.
Powered by Geek Energy.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are at the news. The big one, obviously. Lucasfilm being bought out by Disney. We'll get to that in a second. Let's gloss over these other ones real quick. Have any of you guys seen the World War Z trailer yet?
I have no idea what that is.
World War Z is a zombie novel. It's a zombie book, and Brad Pitt's going to be in the movie, right?
Yeah, Max Brooks, who is the son of Mel Brooks, with such claim to fame as Spaceballs, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, Young Frankenstein, and so on and so forth, Blazing Saddles. Max Brooks wrote the Zombie Apocalypse Survival Guide, which was a how-to survive kind of thing. It read like stereo instructions. But the book that he's most famous for is World War Z, an oral history of the zombie war. And what made it so cool is that in the book, he is this UN person that goes and collects all this data for the United Nations to, like 10 years after the zombie apocalypse has taken place, so that way they know what happened, what they did wrong, and how to prevent it in the future. What he wanted to do was make it into this oral report and keep the human element in. The top brass and all that didn't want it, and that's how the book came about. And it's a really good book. If you haven't read the book, I strongly recommend going to pick it up. It's a fantastic book. But now...
And isn't the book just like sort of point of view of interviews and such?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all done in like first person and stuff like that. And it starts from the beginning, patient zero, with a kid and his father who were diving for treasure in this lake or something like that, and the father dies and the kid gets bit and he's considered patient zero, and it just spreads from there. And the way that Max Brooks writes it is it goes in kind of order, you know, from how it spreads from China to Hong Kong and Thailand, and then just kind of goes from there. And then it goes, anybody that's read the book will know, like the Battle of Yonkers for the United States, when they were showing off all their military might, and it did jack to the zombie horde that just overwhelmed the town. But yeah, the trailer has finally come out for this movie that they pushed back almost a year to the summer of next year. And if anybody hasn't seen that, watch it. It's a good trailer. It doesn't seem like it follows along with a movie with a book too much, but you know, it's a zombie movie.
Oh, I just watched it. It looks very good. It looks well done. Now, I'm not a huge zombie fan, as we've been over. Zombies freak me out. But it does look like it's well made, that's for sure. I mean, hey, you have Brad Pitt in it, you're going to have a lot of money behind it. That's a given.
Yeah, with a book like World War Z, the way that it's written, it would be difficult to make it like that. I mean, it would almost have to be documentary style.
Yeah.
And with the approach that they're doing now, Brad Pitt has even said that he wants this as a trilogy to kind of gloss over everything in the book. We'll see how that pans out with the movie. But so far it looks good. I'm intrigued. I want to check it out. I love the book. I've read the book 5 times. So. But moving forward, Stan Lee confirms that Doctor Strange will be in Phase 3 of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He also says that the Black Panther is being worked on, along with Inhumans and one or two others that he didn't quite mention. But I think that's cool. Doctor Strange got an animated movie, and that was really good. So whatever they can do with a live-action film has to be top notch.
You don't hear Black Panther, Doctor Strange, Guardians of the Galaxy, Inhumans. You start to hear that. Never hear these other Marvel movies that are being made. You can just see them searching around for characters that are not under copyright to Sony and Fox.
Yeah, absolutely. But the characters that are available are still really good. And
no, sure, but they're not the big characters. I mean, no one's. Spider-Man's got a built-in audience, you know. No one's, unless you're a comic fan, you're not necessarily dying for a Doctor Strange movie. Yes, yeah.
Well, and
it doesn't mean it did well. I mean, like Thor did well, so we'll say.
In a kind of small twist, Sony has relinquished merchandising rights for Spider-Man to Disney.
They have. But did not.
Yeah. So it's. Slowly making its way back. Maybe we'll get to see him in something.
Here's my question.
What's that?
Why is Stan Lee breaking this news? I mean, I love the guy, but he hasn't had anything to do with Marvel besides the movies for years.
I assume it's not so much him breaking news as him accidentally telling somebody.
Like...
That's my assumption. He tweeted it by mistake. True believers, there's a mighty Doctor Strange movie coming out. Hamana, whatever.
Excelsior.
Was that 140 characters?
Stan Lee can break whatever he wants. I mean, if he wants to break the news that Spider-Man will go back to Disney, go ahead.
Do you follow Stan Lee on Twitter?
I do.
Yeah, it's you know, he tweets only in, you know, Stanley E's, and it's cool and super annoying.
Because it's like always that Marvel Bob Lucas.
Yeah, it's always 10 tweets in a row.
He's got a lot to say.
He does, but he really doesn't because
he's throwing in all these characters and words that he has no reason using to begin with. So.
Yeah.
It just makes his tweet that much longer.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Before we get to the big news, we have to talk about the terrible news. And that is...
We don't have to.
Well, it at least needs to be mentioned. Mark Wahlberg, who we all know from Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, is official for Transformers number 4. I would have thought and hoped... that they would have stopped making Transformers movies terribly after number 3, but I was wrong, and they're going to.
I wouldn't have hoped that after the first one.
They're going to put Mark Wahlberg in in the fourth one. That
I mean, we don't like the Transformers movies, but can millions of dollars worth of fans be wrong? The answer is yes, they can.
So, like, is he replacing Shia LaBeouf's character?
I believe so.
Oh, please. Oh, oh God, no. No, please.
Move. Go.
I'm going to miss Shia so much.
Are you? Is this going to stop you from seeing any future Transformers films?
Well, I didn't see a third one, so I'm already there. That's true. I watched it on Netflix Instant a couple weeks ago, and yeah, I'm right. I was right. It was terrible.
It was horrendous. It was like the worst 2.5 hours I ever spent in a movie theater next to the Blair Witch 2.
I think Blair Witch 2. Forget. Oh, my God. That was the worst movie of all time.
Right? I didn't even hate that movie, and I wanted to.
I did.
Yeah, so it's bad all around. If anybody thinks that we're wrong, please take it up in the comments section. We'd love to talk to you about this. But let's move on to the big news, which is...
Blair Witch 2 and Cool World is awful, too. Cool World is a terrible movie.
It was a good idea.
Terrible movie, though.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, you know, big news.
Yeah, Lucasfilm buys Disney. But
other way around.
Yeah, that's what I said. Disney buys Lucasfilm.
No.
Right? Yeah.
Yes, that was correct.
That's what I said the first time. But anyway,
remember to edit that out.
The man with the magic pen behind Toy Story 3 and The Hunger Games, Michael Ardent, I think. That's probably wrong. But he is going...
Michael Ardent, that's right.
Yeah, he's going to write the new Star Wars movie.
Okay.
Yep, and rumors are flying that we will see Han, Luke, and Leia come back. That's all speculation right now, but...
Han, Luke, and Leia played by different actors? Han, Luke, and Leia in their 60s?
The way that they're saying it is it'll be Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher, and Harrison Ford. In an interview Harrison Ford did not too long ago, he said that he would seriously entertain the idea of returning as Han Solo if the script...
Oh, Harrison's going to do it. If Harrison came out to Indiana Jones, whatever, he could definitely come out for Star Wars 7.
Well, he likes Indiana Jones more than he likes Star Wars.
Oh.
He'll find that character more than Han. So I remember he wanted Han Solo to die in Jedi.
Was he supposed to?
He wanted Han Solo to die at the end of Empire Strikes Back. That's what he wanted.
Oh.
And Luke said no.
Yeah, well, that was a good move on Lucas's part. Because wouldn't have had a blind Han Solo say, Boba Fett, and then Boba Fett dies.
That's the only reason.
Right, yeah.
Well, here's the main thing that pleased me about that, and Tim, you and I have had conversations about this before, and I said that the best thing that they can do to, if they want more Star Wars movies, was made George Lucas consultant only, and they've done it. So, yeah, that's the movie. Yeah.
See, and I don't even see how much of a consultant he can really be. I mean,
he has an idea of how the universe or his universe is supposed to be structured. So,
right.
If they're writing this film, he can come in, read it, be like, yeah, this doesn't fit because it whatever with this. That's the only thing he needs to do is just make sure that the universe stays intact and makes sense. But other than that, he doesn't need to touch a camera.
That's right. That's right. Go ahead.
Sorry, he said he had given them outlines for the next three movies.
What I understood, and this comes from superherohype.com, is that the next three will be not based on any previously written material.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're going to blow the entire expanded universe out of water.
What I want to see, a singular Boba Fett movie, a 2.5-hour Boba Fett movie. I would be way happy with that.
Yeah, but he died in Jedi.
You mean before that? Like, just like some random Boba Fett adventure?
Yeah, in the Holy Trilogy, there's only so much that Boba Fett is a part of, you know, and his lines can be recited in 2 minutes. Yeah, right? And then to make a movie about him, about how from the last time we see him in the Clone Wars up until his demise in Jedi, what the hell happens to him? You know, how did he become the way he was? How did he get the Mandalorian armor? And why is he this hated and respected and feared badass bounty hunter? That's what I want to see.
Mandalorian armor.
Yeah, that's what I said, Mandalorian armor.
You're wanting a, what's the word? Not so much an origin story, but like you want to see the journey to how he gets there. We already saw that with Vader, and it kind of ruined Vader, so...
But Lucas doesn't have anything to do with Boba Fett now. And somebody can take Boba
Why is this conversation going on? So there's no way to make it a Boba Fett movie.
That's what I want.
Well, you're not going to get it.
I'm a taxpayer. I get what I want.
I don't think you understand how taxes work. <That's true. laughs>
I voted, damn it.
You didn't vote for George Lucas.
No, I did not. So that it's all speculation. I want a Boba Fett movie, and I'm hoping the rumor mill will get started with this conversation right here, and it'll go all the way to the top brass at Disney, and they'll be like, that's actually a pretty good idea, and then they'll take it. And I don't need any credit for it. I just want a good movie.
Doubt it.
It remains to be seen. We have until 2015. And
did you say doubt it? You doubt there's going to be a good movie?
I doubt.
No, I doubt that they're going to make that. This is going to get all the way to the head of Disney, and they're going to make a movie.
I doubt that too.
If the famous Rob Liefeld catches our tweets, then the sky's the limit, sirs.
Rob Liefeld.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
Anyway.
I'm famous for beating a dead horse a lot. So. But, yeah. Moving on.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, a little bit. I think it's a good thing, by the way. As I detailed in my column for the site, I think it's a good move. It's only a win for Star Wars fans and Indiana Jones fans.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
Disney has made some serious business choices in the recent past, and they have been good. I mean, the purchase of Marvel Entertainment and that stable of characters now, Lucasfilm, Industrial Light and Magic, LucasArts,
Wait, so here's one thing. Do they get Skywalker Ranch?
They do.
They got everything.
Wait. They get Skywalker Sound. They don't own Lucas's house.
I don't know. You can just be like, take it all. You think it's just Skywalker?
You're out of here, George. Mickey's moving.
Does he live at the ranch, or is that just the company's production facilities?
I think that's just their production facility. I'm sure he has a house.
I'm sure he's several. If it's not their production facilities, Disney owns that now.
Yeah, any business aspect, the House of
Wars. Skywalker Sound, ILM, LucasArts, whatever.
Yeah, so any movie with special effects from here forward, Disney's making bank on, because ILM does just about everything.
Not everything, but they do the best stuff. They do the best work.
Yeah, pretty close. I mean, they do the Star Trek stuff, and that counts for me. So.
They do Star Trek, and that's everything.
Yeah.
But one Star Trek movie in like the past 10 years.
It's everything, Tom. Leave it alone.
That's right. I don't always make sense, but when I do, it makes perfect sense. So.
I'm working with comics throughout there. My wife and I recently watched Rock of Ages, and it was terrible. So I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet.
Don't bother.
I did buy Prometheus, though, and I'm going to watch it tonight.
Oh, let me know how it is.
Yeah, I've had a couple people that want to sit down with coffee after I watch the film, so that way we can...
No, I just want to know if you liked it, that's all.
Oh, sure, I'll tell you.
It's really good.
One movie I did watch the other day that was really good that I highly recommend is Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
Oh, yeah, that looks interesting.
It really is good. Steve Carell is awesome in that movie, and Keira Knightley is really good too, and Martin Sheen's in that. So, yeah, it's good.
It's non-geek cinema recommendations, right?
Well, it's science fiction, kind of. So.
All right, well, fine. Do you want to shoehorn everything into our cipher right ahead?
All right, we're going to take a break for a second, but when we come back, we're going to hit up the pull list, ladies and gentlemen. That would be the comics that we choose for you to read, and apparently these guys do not like X-Men comics. So we'll be back in just a second.
All right, I'm just going to take a quick look at what's on my pull list. What's this music? What's going on?
Coming this fall on NBC.
What?
A new reality series.
What the hell?
Geek Intervention.
What are you doing in my house?
He was hooked. Addicted. Website.
I'm not addicted to StashMyComics.com.
He couldn't stop cataloging his comic books.
I can stop.
He couldn't stop writing member reviews.
I can stop. I have to go to work.
Locked in a spiral of self-destruction.
It's not...
Inching closer to death with each passing second.
Oh my God. Why are you playing that music?
Wednesdays. On NBC.
Well, I'm not watching because Wednesday night is comic book night.
Oh, really?
Yes, really, yes.
Well, it's the new Walking Dead out this week.
Yeah, I'm actually going to the comic book shop now. It's, do you want to ride or something?
Well, if you're going that way, I guess.
Alright, let's go. I'm going now.
Geek Intervention, Wednesdays on NBC.
Alright, ladies and gentlemen, we are at the pull list, the comics that we chose for you, the listener, to take a look at. This week, we have for you, since it's our annual episode, we have Green Lantern Annual Number 1, and that comes from the New 52. And we also have Uncanny X-Men Annual Number 11. I chose that. But first, let's go ahead and go with Green Lantern Annual Number 1. Jason, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Basically picks up where, I think, Green Lantern 12 left off with Green Lantern Sinestro fighting Black Hand, and then it bleeds into the Guardians enacting their plan to create the Third Army. That's about it.
So it's written by Geoff Johns. Who,
of course,
who right now is like the premier Green Lantern writer, and yeah. The artwork is by Ethan Van Siever.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go ahead and start with you, Jason. What did you get out of this issue? What did you think about it?
Well, I don't know if you guys are aware, but I'm still a Green Lantern fan. it's really good. Yeah, it's really good. I think it just showcases how crazy the Guardians are, which, yeah, they're psychotic now. They're just trying to ruin everything.
That is the one thing that I think surprised me the most, because usually they're these kind of centered,
calm, cool, collected.
Yeah, and they kind of quell Jordan or Guy Gardner and all that stuff, and make sure that order is out of chaos. But the first thing you see in this issue is the Guardians all surrounding, whatever, and they're talking about how chaos is everywhere. The universe is full of hatred and sin and all this stuff, and they were unlucky with the First Army, which they go after. Yeah, the Manhunters, and then the Second Army, which was the Corps. And that was a failure to them, and now they have to eradicate everything and bring about the Third Army.
Well, and the thing that really just shows how far gone they are is when the one Guardian murders the other one.
Holy smokes!
And that's like high crime with them. They got pissed at how to kill Krona, and Krona was going to wipe out the Corps. So, yeah.
Yeah, like when they're going after the Shadow Realm or wherever it was that they made that prison, and they had their other
They're brothers.
Yeah, to guard him, to make sure that nobody tried to free him under any circumstances. And I love when the one guardian's standing there and he says, "Step aside, brother. You know, we need him, and you can either step aside or we can force you to step aside." And the other one's like, "You told us not to let anybody in. We're not going to do that. You're going to have to kill us to get him." And they do. What I got out of this is it's like how the issue starts. It's a quick catch up to what's going on. And you don't necessarily need to read the past 12 issues to kind of get the gist of what's going on. Everything kind of builds up to this, but if you come in at this, it starts it off good. They give a good explanation, really quick, 2-3 pages, and then you're into it. They don't waste any time, and it all kind of makes sense. Black Hand looks really cool, though. That was the first time I ever saw him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's nice to see more Guardians, you know, with a race of them, to see them interact and go at it. Seaver's artwork, though, is fantastic. It's outstanding. I love his great attention to detail, his emotion, the background. Every piece of the page is utilized and noticed. But, Tom, what were your thoughts on this?
Yeah, Vance David doing Green Lantern is always good, even though Adam Newcomb disagrees with us on that one. I haven't followed Green Lantern in the New 52, and I agree, Tim, this is a nice jumping-on point. You don't need to have necessarily been reading to get what's going on in the story. It is an interesting twist to have Guardians decide that they're going to, well, eradicate free will from the galaxy, and that will bring order. Chaos to cast the Guardians as villains. That's interesting. I would worry that it would be almost, if it becomes a big cosmic event, I worry it would be almost too reminiscent of both Sinister Core War and the Ring War, or what was that called? I'm talking about the final Darkest Night? Blackest Night,
yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, you worry maybe it's the same story, just different villains. But it's interesting enough for you to want to pick up, I think, the next issue and start following it and see what, not that I'm necessarily going to, and see what's to come. Let me ask a question. What is a bigger reveal you're more anxious to see? Who is the first Lantern, which I thought was a good idea, or where Hal Jordan / Sinestro's ring is going to land?
That I'm more interested in, like who's it going to be? Because Kyle...
Do you want me to tell you?
No. Unless you want...
Are you that way? You know?
Yeah, it's picked up. We're in Green Lantern 14. His ring chose Simon Baez, he's the first Middle Eastern Green Lantern.
So it's okay, the new character.
Because we have to be culturally diverse.
Well, it's a new character. is it a new character?
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
He is.
Yeah. Well, all right, that's cool.
Oh, my God. We didn't have enough Green Lanterns on Earth.
Right, because we've got two already. Three. Three.
Five.
That's what I said, five.
He's the fifth, yeah.
Yeah.
Technically six, if you want to count Alan Scott.
He's on Earth.
Just saying.
All right.
Well, look, I do think it was well done and big time and a story worthy of one of the it's not an A-list title of DC, but a B-plus title. I think Green Lantern at this point is an A-lister.
I thought that this particular issue flowed like the season finale of a series or even the last in a movie series or something like that. It was really dramatic. Like, Geoff Johns' plot plays out and flows just like something like that. And that was a real joy to me.
I think the season finale is a nice comparison because clearly it's big and big ramifications, but it's not, the story's not over yet. I'm going to have to tune in September to see what happens, or next month.
The one thing that a lot of people griped about, and I didn't see it, was that they focused like one short panel on the death of Jordan and Sinistro, but it's not even really stated if they're dead, because the ring itself, well, no, because the ring was saying error, 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 you know, so where did they go? Are they
inside the ring?
Dead.
See, there you go. There you go.
They're inside the ring.
Okay.
The first time.
No way they're dead.
So, final thoughts, Jason. 1 through 10, what do you give Green Lantern Annual number 1?
8.5.
8.5. Why an 8.5?
Writing's really good. Art's really good. It's a really good issue. Plus the cover's just cool.
I did like that. It's a reminiscent.
Yes, Man 75. It's a swipe. It's great.
It's good stuff. Tom, final thoughts? Green Lantern Annual number 1, 1 through 10. What do you give that?
8.2634.
Wow. Way to be difficult.
He's always got to be different.
Okay, yeah. It's very solid, very good, and you know what's nice? It's an annual that actually serves a function, and it's a nice jumping on point, I think, for new readers, because it's clearly a big story. But because of that, it's not a complete story, and that's what comics are. They're serialized storytelling, they're pull points to make you want to buy the next issue, and it certainly serves that purpose well.
I gave this an overall 10. Out of 10, and the reason for that is because of how well the script was written out. Jeff Johns' script was awesome, and the whole time I was reading that annual, it felt just like, you know, the season finale of the series or something like that, and that is totally epic to me, and it really flowed really nicely, and Ethan Van Siever's artwork to complement a script like that is astounding, and that just made it all the more interactive for me, and such a joy to read. That's one of the best new titles, new issues that I've read in quite a while. So,
you know, that's my point, Tim. I'm not saying this is a good issue where you give it a 10 out of 10. You give out scores like the judges on Dancing with the Stars, which I know since I've watched it, where everything, whether they say that was fantastic or, oh, that was terrible, every score is between an 8 and 10. It's ridiculous. And you give Amazing Spider-Man a 6.5.
That's right. It earned its 6.5.
I mean, you give Faces of Death a higher score than 6.5.
No. No.
That monkey stuff.
I've seen a few of those, and some of them have given me shivers well past my viewing experience of those films.
Like, oh, that was horrendous, and human, that shouldn't have existed. That should be ashamed of itself. I give it a 10.
All right, let's move on to the next annual. Tim's going to give an 11 too.
Okay.
Well, I might not give it an 11, but I'll give it something.
I'll just keep going.
Okay, so this is Uncanny X-Men Annual number 11. I have talked about this annual a lot over the course of us being on the podcast. This was the first comic book that I ever really read. This was my introduction into the greater world that is the Marvel Universe.
And I guess what amazes me about that is that this is the first comic you ever really read, and you've continued to read them.
I love this issue. This is one of my favorite issues because of how good it is, and we'll get into that. So let me give you a rundown of what it's about. In the beginning, do what?
Please do.
In the beginning, you have Wolverine who's lollygagging and strolling toward the mansion. He's as drunk as he can get with his healing factor, and he kind of wakes up the whole mansion, or at least the team that's there, and that consists of Dazzler, Longshot, Storm, Havoc, Rogue, Psylocke before she became super hot and Asian, and a visit from Captain Britain and Megan. Those of you,
you know, the A-team.
Yeah. But the point is after they reprimand Logan for being a slob, you know, and him really not caring and continuing to drink enormous amounts of alcohol, they all kind of retire to their rooms, wherein this guy who calls himself Horde appears, beats the X-Men within minutes, and then takes them to this alternate dimension where he needs them to get this crystal for him. And the crystal is what gives you your ultimate desire or totally makes believable your darkest fears. And the story just progresses from there. So, Jason, I know you didn't like it, but tell me why you didn't like it. What was wrong with this issue?
Good Lord, where to start? first like five panels, I knew I didn't like it or wouldn't like it just because I hate when they do song lyrics in a comic book. I never read them. There's no point.
Because unless you really know the song, then you don't know.
Well, no, it's just not even that. Just, like, he's singing, okay? And then he got into some boring dialogue, and I mean, he just it dated itself instantly by he called her Daz Darling instead of just Dazzled her. Yeah, just, I don't know. I guess it got better, but it was just, It was just a story.
Okay, fair enough. Tom, what are your thoughts on this?
My first thought is probably, look, I didn't hate it on site as much as Jason did. Then I got to the villain design. Have you seen Horde again at any point?
No, this is the only issue he's ever been in.
That's a good idea. although I do like the completely naked intergalactic dude with the giant metal V that he's wearing for shorts. Very, very intimidating. It's one of those, and comics cover across these ones as well. They seem to be like really popular in the 80s. The psychobabble, you're into the superheroes, artist desires. It's just this cosmic mishmash of what the hell is going on all time through. So it's not a favorite type of story of mine. Look, it's not a terrible X-Men team. It's not the worst it's ever been. Not the A-team, per se. But well, there's nothing wrong with the artwork. I think the artwork is fine.
Alan Davis' artwork, to me, is really good for the time period.
It finds even too soft to wear. I think it's actually very good artwork. It fits into it feels like an 80s comic in the artwork.
Yeah.
And especially when you consider the mohawks and mullets.
Longshot and Storm. Yeah, that's right.
But this is what an annual, the Green Lantern annual was when it was done right, and this is when an annual is done wrong. It's throwaway. There's no purpose. You know what I mean? It's like there's no reason for this to exist. It's a throwaway villain. I mean, look, I like one shot stories too, but this is kind of a throwaway villain. It's kind of a dreary story. It's not very exciting. It's.
And I have to disagree with you both on that because that is not what I got out of this at all. This is one of my favorite issues to read. I will read this from time to time. And nostalgia aside, the story, even reading it now compared to reading it then, it still brings across the same thing. It brings across a sense of hopelessness and fear and longing for what you desire the most. I mean, like with Havoc, he had to control himself and contain himself and never be able to unleash, you know, his full potential. And in this issue, he's able to do that.
I get that, Timmy. I don't know that the sense of hopelessness, fear, and longing to get your heart to, you know, hopelessness and fear. I don't know if those are the reasons people read superhero comics, because they want hopelessness and fear. I think that's why you watch a horror movie.
Well, you get that out of this. That's there. Claremont, I think that this is some of his best work in a single issue format. Not over several issue story arcs like the Dark Phoenix saga or
something. This is not his best work.
I think even Chris Claremont will disagree with you strongly.
Chris Claremont is very. Chris Claremont, can you read my other work? Seriously, this is what you're picking?
This
Chris thing Claremont's probably tried to buy all these to burn them.
You guys are terrible.
it's like you created horror on a dare.
It's like they had a bunch of stories that they had to pick for an annual, and they're like, oh, well, here's this one. Let's just throw it together. All right, let's go.
Ladies and gentlemen of the listening audience, do not listen to Jason.
It's like he pitched it as a 12 issue story arc, and his editor was like, let's just do this in the annual.
Oh my god!
It's like he pitched it as a joke, and he thought he was serious.
You guys are horrible. You're horrible. That's what you are. Both of you.
Also right.
I hope you guys get covered in 20 feet of snow over the course of the winter.
Thanks for that. Appreciate it. Because we're in strange weather in New York has been happening the past couple years.
Okay, so final thought.
My parents moved to Buffalo 4 years ago, and I've been much better than them ever since.
Jason, 1 through 10, what would you give this issue?
5.
5. You are lame, sir.
Ish.
Ish.
I mean, I don't know.
Tom, what about you?
3.
A 3?
Mm-hmm.
You're even worse.
Yeah, you know,
you're
being Spider-Man 6.5, I can play that game.
Tommy is vindictive.
You know what, I give him a -3.
I give this a 9.5 out of 10.
You're an idiot.
No, I'm not.
You know what, this is, you are, this is worse, this book is worse than Maximum Overdrive.
No, not at all, never, don't you dare speak that. That's wrong. It's wrong. We will delete that from the record. Matt, when you produce this episode, remove Tom's comment about Maximum Overdrive, please.
Can we move on to the trivia? Good lord.
Alright. We're gonna take a break for a second, let Tom and Jason collect themselves after reading such an awesome issue. But when we come back, we're gonna hit up trivia. Tom's got that for us. And then we're going to get to the weekly distraction of this annual, which is the awesome interview with Todd McFarlane. We'll be right back in just a second. StashMyComics.com, powered by Geek Energy. All right, guys, we're at trivia. Tom, won't you go ahead and get us started?
Okay, well, I don't have the rules in front of me, so I'm going to just make them up.
That's fine.
If you guess the answer, you get a pony. No one who is one-legged can guess. Is that discriminatory? I guess we can't do that. Someone jump in and give me the rules.
We can't discriminate against
people. No, we can't. So somebody give me the friggin' rule. I don't know.
If you are not a member of the StashMyComics.com podcast, go ahead and become a member, because if you're not a member, you can't vote, or you can't guess, whatever it is. We already had voting, and Obama won, but we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, always major politics in this. How?
He does. It's crazy. It's late.
Have you guys seen my Facebook? Do you see what my father and other members of my family spew out for political propaganda? Thank God.
I haven't. Are they big pro-Obama supporters?
They are pro-Republican, and they're very passionate about that.
So they had a very good night the other night.
They had a terrible night, isn't that?
A freaking landslide.
My dad lost some family members on Facebook because of the election results.
Wow.
Yeah.
One of those guys.
It gets pretty heated. I love my dad. And Dad, if you're listening, no offense or nothing, but you need to not be a sore loser.
We were very excited here in Brooklyn. It was a good day.
Well, my state's a Republican state, so I knew that it was going to vote Republican.
Yeah. But What state are you?
Tennessee.
What a shock.
Yeah, right?
There's a line in The Daily Show where Jon Stewart's like, well, we like to confirm that Mitt Romney has won the Confederacy.
I knew it was going to happen, but, you know, I was part of the 30% that didn't vote for him. So.
All right.
But anyways, moving on.
Trivia.
Yeah, trivia. You have to be a member of StashMyComics.com podcast. If you work for or are represented by StashMyComics in any way, shape, or form, you are not eligible to play. The Two Guns Initiative, if you won on the last week's episode. You cannot guess on this week's, but you can on the week after. Aside from that, the rest of you guys know the rules. I don't think we need to explain the rest of them to you. So, Tom, take it away.
All right. Okay. So, in honor of the big Disney purchasing Star Wars news, I have a question that reflects both Disney and Star Wars. So, we're ready? All right, here we go. In the original, Should I go?
Yeah, go ahead. Go.
Okay. Should I go?
Yes, go.
Okay. The MGM Studios original Star Tours attraction, what is the official alphanumeric designation of a droid who pilots the ride?
Oh, wow. Wow, right on. If you guys can guess that, then you will win something awesome. Because it's the annual edition, we won't give you a comic book code. We'll go ahead and give you a digital download for a movie. How about that? Sounds good to me.
Yeah, that's right. That's
right. Great. There you go. Yeah. So okay, so we're going to take a break. When we come back, Tom and Jason are going to kind of back out so you guys can take a listen to this 58-minute interview extravaganza with Todd McFarlane. We talk about the new visual biography that comes out the 21st of November. We talk the start of Image Comics. We talk Spider-Man. We talk how Todd McFarlane got his start and what he had to do, and his thoughts and ideas on how you can become a good artist and how he could even teach you how to be a good artist.
but no Mark McGuire, huh?
I feel like you covered all this before.
We have, but...
Did you ask him what he thinks of Uncanny X-Men Annual number 11?
I did not.
I thought it sucked.
He probably would have liked it.
Yeah, he would have loved it.
Well, if Todd McFarlane is listening to this, which he probably isn't, but if he is, then he can reply in the comments section like everybody else and tell us how awesome Uncanny X-Men Annual number 11 is. There was one cool thing, though, and he answers this in the interview where we talk about what his most expensive and collectible comic book is. And without missing a beat, that man said Action Comics number 1.
He owns Action Comics number 1?
That's what he says.
Sweet.
Right?
When you're Tom McFarlane, I guess you get stuff like that.
He can have whatever he wants. He at one point owned the cover design for Amazing 328.
Wait, does he say almost in the interview, Tim?
What? About Action Comics number 1?
Yeah. Just play the interview.
I'm giving,
get to the people didn't want to even listen to us for the first hour of the podcast, and it was just play the interview. We're gonna go Jason and I are out of here, people. You get to listen to Tim and Tom McFarlane talk about Mystery Men.
For an hour.
All right.
We'll be right back in just a second.
Geek Hotline, how may I help you?
Hello. I was looking for a solution on how to better track my comic book collection. I've been using memory and pen and paper for a while, but it's not really working out well for me. What can you suggest?
That's a very good question, sir. I'll have to consult my fax machine.
I don't understand.
Excuse me, sir. I'm going to have to ask you to stay quiet while I concentrate in order to better serve you. Since you broke my concentration, I'm going to have to go over to my next machine here.
Why are you using Morse code? I think I better call back another time.
I'm afraid I'm not getting any answer to your question here. Let me just move over to this next piece of technology that I have.
Is that a foghorn? Am I hearing a foghorn?
Excuse me, sir. I'm sorry, I can't get the answer to your question at this time. But if I can ask you to hold the line, please, I will get that answer for you as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Hello? just drive off? Heck with it. I'll just use stashmycomics.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you to a very special interview today for stashmycomics.com podcast. This man needs no introduction, but we're going to go ahead and give him one anyways. He wrote and drew Spider-Man, he drew Batman, he drew the iconic characters from Marvel and DC, and he also created Spawn. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce Mr. Todd McFarlane. Todd, how are you today?
Good. How are you guys doing over there?
We're doing fantastic. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me on tonight. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. We were looking forward to it. I want to talk today about your visual biography. That is something that I know I've been waiting a long time to see. I mean, from when I was a kid collecting comic books in high school and in middle school, reading your work on Spider-Man and even Batman and things like that, it was just so fascinating to see the visual aspect that you were able to create. And with the visual biography that's going to be coming out in a couple of weeks, that really dives into not only your creative process, but also how you got your start. And I think that, to me, was a little more intriguing than anything else. So let's talk about that for a second. Tell me.
Well, let me just make a comment here quickly before we go, is that the book you're referencing, you know, when we sat down and were beginning to put it together, there's sort of three books that I would buy when I was younger. There's sort of the tutorial book, right? The, you know, mm-hmm. how to draw a book, if you will.
Right.
There's you know, I've bought plenty of quote-unquote art books, but those always left me a little bit sort of flat because there was a lot of pretty pictures, but there wasn't a lot of writing about it. You just looked at the pictures and I never really sort of got a sense, I got an understanding of why it all existed.
Right.
And then there's just people who write their memoirs, if you will, right?
Right.
And so we, as we sat there, we tried to figure out and whether it even made any sense. Can we actually sort of amalgamate all three of those together so people could see what originally started as an art book? Then we said, well, why don't we give some story behind it? And in the places where I don't want to bore them with my life, then I can at least then maybe give them and tell them what's in my head, or give some tutorials, some sort of teacher sort of lessons for those that may be interested. That, again, nothing that you see in this book was ever done in a vacuum. I was always thinking about something. Not that it was right or wrong, but that there was a process in my head while I was doing it. And that then turns out to be the book that you have in your hands. And it's going to be curious when it comes out whether we struck the right balance or whether people are going to go, you should have put more pictures or more writing or more tutorial. But that's sort of the essence of how that book even came to be.
Well, see, to be honest with you, the aspect that I liked the most about the visual biography wasn't so much the story and even the fantastic artwork that you put into it, but it really had a definitive beginning, middle, and end. Well, I mean, where we are today. In the beginning, it showed, and you could see how your artwork had begun to craft itself and to start, and where you did just the poster poses, like you called them, and then eventually through, I believe it was the help of the DC editor, correct me if I'm wrong on that, that kind of gave you the push to do plotted stories with the storyboards. And then,
yeah, well the one of the things is that I'm hoping would be somewhat of an inspiration to a couple people who were, you know, looking to break into the business, is that I wanted to put as much artwork as I could throughout time so people could see that at least for a guy like me, and it's not necessarily true for every artist, because I've met some really super talented people, is that for me, my skill has been a constant work in progress, right? And
absolutely.
And one of the things I wanted to, hopefully people will get, is that you could go almost up to your mom or your dad and say, hey, look at page, you know, 40, and then now look at page 240, and that your mom or dad would go, that's not even the same person. Right, artistically, that can't be the same person, and so the reason that's important, I think, is that when I was younger, the guys that inspired me the most were not the guys that were fully formed and that were at the top of the game. It was the guys that weren't very good, and I would look at them and get inspired by them because I would say, wow, that's not very good, and I think I could be at least that good, right?
Right, absolutely.
So what I'm hoping for is that people will go, wow, I don't have to be, to break in, I don't have to be Todd McFarlane, you know, now the fully developed artist. When I look at what Todd used to be, I can't even believe that they gave him a job in the first place, right? but now that they did give him a job, then I busted my ass and I put in a lot of hard work and a lot of long days and nights to actually then improve the skill that was below mediocre when I first broke in. I'd be the first to admit it. So I'm hoping that people then they're reading it going, wow, I don't have to be that good. I just need to get in the business, and maybe if with a little bit of luck and I keep working, I'll be able to improve myself like a lot of artists do, and in this particular case, like Todd McFarlane did.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, you can definitely tell that, and I think a lot of people will get that out of this biography that you have put out with the comparison with story, with your personal history, and the amount of the sheer number of artwork that you've supplied for us to take a look at. It's so amazing to see how the process goes where you craft an idea and then you take it a step further and ink it yourself, and then even a step further, you know, with the coloring and choosing the right letters and stuff like that. For me, that showed that if I didn't have a great sense of it before, I definitely do now, that each individual part of creating that image is significant more so than anything else. You need all of those pieces to make that, and to show your journey from the beginning when you sent numerous letters out to try and get your foot in the door, and you kept all those rejection letters, and you kept a mark of how and when all of that took place, and then the one person gives you that chance on a series that's two issues away from being finished. That's all you needed, was that one foot in the door.
All right, and for anybody that may be listening that has aspirations of breaking into art, not necessarily comic book art, and I can argue that comic book art is kind of a tough place at times because they expect you to know how to draw a little bit of everything, sort of a jack of all trades, master of none. You have to be able to draw cars and bushes and trees, and you have to be able to do monsters and ray guns and explosions and buildings and architecture. I mean, you got to be able to do a little bit of all that. But, comma, if you only find one skill in art, you can make a great living in a lot of fields, and Hollywood is one of them, and video games is another.
Absolutely.
Because if you I've been involved in video games, and I have a group of people who do costume designs. That's all I do. I'll break them into categories. Somebody else then does, you know, the male figure. Some do the female figure. If I should do the monsters, sometimes aren't even the guys who do the humans because they're not very good at, like, human anatomy. Then you got people who do nothing but weapons. And then you got people who and once you take that, then have to then make a model, a 3D model of it for, let's say, a video game. They can't really draw, but once somebody's given them a drawing, they're fantastic at modeling. And then somebody then takes the model who can't draw and says, oh, my job is to make it move. I'm the animator. And they're fantastic at that, but they're not very good at any of the other things I just mentioned. And then somebody else comes along and has to do things like, oh, I gotta design buildings. Somebody else does the sky, the color, and the shadow. Somebody else does music. Somebody else does sound effects. Somebody else does spell casting. Each one of these is an individual group of people. And don't take my word for it. All you have to do is go and look at, like, all those names at the end of a movie, and each one of those people is doing a skill. But they hand out Academy Awards for sound effects, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So you don't have to be Brad Pitt, nor do you have to be Steven Spielberg. It'd be cool if you can, but if you can't, it shouldn't diminish your want and need to get into that business, because you may just be the best set designer that anybody's ever seen. You'd be the best person for special effects. You may be the best person for music or sound effects or sport. So, and when you sort of break it down, I think it becomes less intimidating for people that they have to sort of be great at all of these trades. You
right.
don't. You have yeah, you can learn one and have a very, very good career for a long time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if anything, this book definitely teaches that you need to find what you're good at and what you excel at and then take it to the limits. I mean, you did that by getting into Marvel and then going to DC and eventually writing and drawing characters that you grew up and loved. And that even goes so far as to when Marvel gave you Spider-Man to draw and then later to write and to draw. And that brings me to a question. Oh, go ahead.
Well, let me just say something about drawing. I have this argument with my wife from time to time. I believe I can train people to become good artists. Right? I think you could give me anything, and I could get them to be a good artist. She doesn't believe that, but and there may even be skeptics listening right now. But here's how it works: drawing and being an artist is no different than any other occupation. If you do it 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, I promise you, and you have a decent sort of a boss or manager that's teaching you something, you will get better. It's near impossible for any skill on the planet for 40 hours of the week and not get better at it.
Absolutely.
And so now, again, I'm not saying you become great. That becomes the intangible, right?
Right.
Like, in other words, like why is it that you can give a basketball and a certain height to Michael Jordan and give it to other people, and you get two different results? It's the same tool. It's the same rule of the game, but one guy excels better than the other. That's just, at some point, those are just God-given skills that you can't sort of put on a spreadsheet. But there's still basics that you can teach people. So within the confines of that, the only reason I think I'm better than arguably any one of your listeners right now is because I've had the good fortune of somebody paying me to do it 10 hours a day for a lot of years. So it's learning a language. If I was to say to anybody listening, I can teach you German, you'd scoff. But if you gave me 8 hours a day and I brought in a German teacher in, I bet you in 2 years, you'd be pretty good at German. Not completely fluent, but because you gave me those number of hours. They've done the test. People who say they can't draw, you know, when you do Pictionary with your friends, they go, I'm never be able to draw. So the report that they come in with, and I buy into it. Again, it's not scientific, but it's theory, but I buy into it. But the brain stops its development of a skill from the moment that you stop doing it. So, for instance, if you stop really drawing in your life when you were 12, because all of a sudden you went to junior high and you went to high school and you didn't take any more art classes, really, That if you stopped at 12 and you're now 42 years old and you put the Pictionary and you start drawing, your brain goes back to 12 because that's the last piece of information you put into the computer was the skill of a 12-year-old. And so it just goes back to when you stop. It hasn't gotten better by not doing it. You can't just magically go, I'm going to sit around and not do anything in art and magically get better at it. It doesn't work that way. And so they're saying that there's a connection from the starting and the stopping of the skill to when you basically do it again. And so you want to be better at art? I know you do it like a 12-year-old because that's the last time you made any concentrated effort at it. And make a concentrated effort and catch yourself up to the age of 42, you can probably get there in a couple of years.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that even takes it so far as to where my artistic abilities are now because of where I stopped, and I can't do anything more than stick figures. But taking your advice, if I move forward and try and push and become passionate about it, absolutely, I could become a great artist. Maybe not to the extent that where you're at now, but in time, I could become comfortable with what I have and maybe make a living out of it.
Right, that's it. Right, you'd be a functional artist.
That's right, absolutely. Right.
And the greatness is all on you. That's an internal thing. Nobody gets to teach that.
That's right, absolutely. I mean, with me, artwork isn't so much my passion as it is writing and music. I've been playing the bass guitar for over 10 years, and I play that hours a day. I have to stay not only proficient, but to become better. And that falls right in line with what you were just saying about artwork.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Learning is just a learning process.
Absolutely.
We can all do it. So anybody who thinks they can't do it, I'm telling you, I promise you, you can do it.
And see, with that learning process, that takes us to the creation of Image Comics. Undoubtedly, and it goes without saying, one of the greatest comic book creations since the Marvel Universe. I mean, Image is a huge company with several titles, great titles, Spawn included, Savage Dragon, The Walking Dead, Rebel Blood. The list just goes on and on as far as what Image is constantly putting out, and they're putting out great material, and that's the thing. But it all had to start somewhere, and it started with you and a couple of other guys that just kind of got tired of what was going on with them at the bigger companies, and you guys felt that you could do it on your own, and you did.
Well, you know, again, you know, everybody sort of wired a little bit differently. So each one of us that became one of the founders of Image left for their own personal reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Mine was fairly simplistic. I just wanted to draw the comic books that I came up with in my mind, and I didn't want to get bogged down with stuff. And over the course of my years working at both Marvel and DC, you know, there was always sort of corporate starts and stops that you couldn't do. And
right.
You know, I was, you know, getting, you know, somewhat reprimanded for some of the changes I was making on Spider-Man, because again, it was their status quo. And it was their guy, their company logo, if you will.
Right.
And I was messing around with them, and the whole time the sales were going up, and I was getting, it was frustrating me slowly that, you know, I was selling comic books at a rapid rate, and I it seemed like I couldn't sort of please them, right? It was always like, Todd, you know, whoa, enough of that, right? You know,
right.
I was, oh, what are you doing? And I had these odd conversations of like, why don't you talk to the guys that are selling half of them? So it's a weird conversation. You're talking to me. And I sell more books than anybody else in the country right now. Why don't you talk to the other guy? Or why don't you advertise Spider-Man and say, oh, we don't need to because it sounds so well. Oh, wow, really? Are you saying Hershey shouldn't advertise its Papa Bar anymore because it sells so good? I mean, that's not how businesses work. They actually promote the stuff that sells, right? They promote
Absolutely.
A Harry Potter book. When you go into a bookstore, there's a lot of Harry Potter books, and they promote that. They don't sit there and say, oh, yeah, there's a book in the back, you know, about how to build your own eyeglasses that not a lot of people are buying, but you know what? We can give it a chance, and so we can promote that one even more. So there's like all this odd stuff, but eventually I just went, you know what, guys? I'm done. I'm just going to go and just have some fun and do what I got to do and not have these sort of silly conversations about what's in the comics code,
right,
or what isn't in the comics code, or whatever. And luckily, and again, it, you know, began with conversations with Rob Liefeld and Mark. They were already, you know, talking about doing their own independent books. They were going to go off and do their own thing. And all of a sudden, we sort of sitting there going, hey, there's three of us going to go off on our own, maybe do our own different thing. Why would three of us go in three different directions? Why don't we glue ourselves together? And so there were three of us real quick. Jim Valentino, who knew Rob, was there very quickly. There's four. We thought that was enough to begin our track. We go to New York to basically tell Marvel we're quitting. You know, that night we happened to be staying in a hotel that, for whatever reason, Mark Silvestri was in town. So I met him in the lobby, and I gave him a hell of a sales pitch. And I said, hey, we're going to go tell Marvel and DC that we're quitting. You want to join us? I gave him the pitch, and I go, but by the way, you got to sleep on it and give us an answer at 7 in the morning. And he, you know, fortunately woke up and said, I'm in.
You can definitely tell the limits
in
that you
hotel. You wouldn't even been part of Image. But then we ran into Jim Lee a little bit later, and the same thing. Jim, if you come on board, you're like a golden child, and if you jump on board, then like Rob and I were sort of the pistols, you know, we were sort of the rebels, so people knew that we were already sort of out the door. But Jim Lee was sort of the coup for us, and I knew that would send really the biggest message if we could get Jim Lee. And then with Jim came Will Spartaccio, and all of a sudden, you know, we went from 4 to 7 real quick, and it made a huge impact when we were able to basically finally make our announcement that yes, indeed, there was going to be this new company, and look at the 7 of us, you know, and look at our track record.
Absolutely. I mean, you had the likes of the X-Men writers, X-Force, you on Spider-Man, and Valentino doing Guardians of the Galaxy. That sent a major message, and Image Comics became a result of that. And then with the release of Youngblood, with Liefeld's work, that sold massively. And then with Spawn, your title coming out, I mean, that still holds the record to this day for largest amount of issues sold for an independent comic, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's great to see in your biography the formulation and creation of Spawn, how you started way back when you were still sending those letters out to just try and get your foot in the door, up to the creation of the logo itself and the promo artwork. I can still remember the Wizard issue that had the Spawn promotional artwork. That me and my friends fought over that issue. Who was going to get it? Who was going to read it? Who was going to take the poster out? But, I mean, Spawn number one became a franchise at that point. I mean, from that moment forward, it's still an ongoing series, a great ongoing series, and it spawned an animated series on HBO, which was critically acclaimed. It spawned a live-action movie, which some may or may not agree is good or not. I enjoyed it. I loved it. And I can't wait to see what you have in store for Spawn next, either on the silver screen or on the smaller screen.
Well, like I said, I created Spawn when I was a kid. And I just sort of put them away. I mean, if nobody ever gave me a comic book job, I was going to do a Spawn comic book anyways, right? So I actually started. I still have the original pages when I was a kid.
That's great.
But I never pulled them out. You know, there was never any time when I was ever working with Marvel or DC where I ever felt inclined to pull any of my characters out of the satchel and put them on the table. Because, you know, there's thousands of great characters that Marvel and DC had themselves, right? So to me, I was having more fun trying to take their characters and do something with it than worry about that. But once we started Image, you know, one of the things... thought that they might care about is that they sort of like my artwork. So, you know, if I go over to help create another company and I do this character that's completely unknown, that's called Spawn,
mm-hmm.
Then people just have to buy it by default, right? They're going, Spawn, I don't know what that is, but Spawn, I don't care. But it's got Todd's artwork in it, so I'm going to buy it. And then at that point, we knew we'd all launch our books because people liked their artwork. The bigger hurdle then became, could we be skilled enough to create new characters that would be lasting that we could then sell month in and month out? And then all of a sudden, you know, because I remember when I was collecting, I was always envious of these books that were up to issue 200, 300, 400, right? Action Comics, Detective Comics. I was like, oh, you know, someday I could ever have a book that's up to issue 400. Awesome. Been fortunate so far. We're up to 225, so I got to write 26 this week, and we'll just keep pounding it out, right?
Right on. That sounds great. Let me ask you a question though. Taking it back to Spider-Man for a minute, with Torment. Torment was and is one of the greatest Spider-Man stories ever told. Both with artwork and with your writing there, you took what I thought was a second-rate villain in the Lizard, and you made a 5-issue arc that was fantastic and made you really wonder what the heck was going to happen to Spider-Man in the next issue. And then you didn't stop there, and you took it with the Hobgoblin and Ghost Rider in the issues following, and then again with Wendigo and Wolverine, and then with Morbius. But I always wanted to ask you, was there ever a Spider-Man story that you wanted to write that you never had the chance to do?
Yeah, the only one I got caught short on that again, I quit before, I wanted to do, not necessarily a story, but I wanted to do a scene in which, you know, fairly typical, you know, stereotype, you know, you got your, you know, Wall Street white dude walking down the street, and then all of a sudden, you know, some black guy comes and pulls him around the corner and can mug him. And then Spider-Man comes in to save the day, right?
Right.
And then he webs up the murderer and you know, saves the day. And as the Wall Street guy is walking away, he says, "Thanks, Spider-Man." He goes, "I don't get why those," and he sort of says an epithet, you know, a derogatory name calling to the mugger. And Spider-Man at that moment slams the Wall Street guy into the wall and gets right into his face and says, "What color do you think I am underneath this mask?"
Wow.
And the reason was is that it always bothered me that guys like Spider-Man that were covered from head to toe, who sort of just acted and wrote stories and assumed that he was sort of like the white dude, right? I mean,
right.
Because Superman and Batman and everybody else was, and it would I just wanted to just give doubt to that Wall Street guy for just a blink of an eye, that it's like, well, I don't know, is he Hispanic, Korean? I mean, who, you don't know, because I've taken away that visual ID, that stereotype we have there of the costumes. And so those are some of the themes that were sort of going and playing through my brain, that, you know, I ended up taking some of those and moving them over into Spawn, you know, not in a big way, right? I was never sort of a big fan of, you know, saying, you know, I'm going to do Luke Cage or Black Panther because I want, you know, minorities to read the book. I never wanted that. I just wanted to create a character that people would pay attention to, and I didn't want to draw any attention to it one way or the other, right? I just wanted to have a cool character, which is why in Spawn 1, I just sort of stripped the skin away from him in the first one, put a costume from head to toe, and go, "We're good. Just took care of that problem. Boom, you know, we got here." But in Spider-Man, it was more of, going back to what you were saying with Torment, the idea there was that every story, at least that I had read about Doc Connor, was the exact same story. It was just a regurgitation of the original Stan Lee story.
Right.
So everybody for 20 years had basically been doing the exact same story, that he's the professor and that Peter Parker comes and it's late at night and he grows into the lizard and he starts using all those acids, you know, "Spider-Man, I will slay you if it's the last thing I do." And I just go, I felt like I'd read that story. And I never understood why people wouldn't want to look at what has already been there and then take some homage to it, but then go off and do something sort of new and interesting, which is why I think a guy like Alan Moore was so brilliant. He was able to look at certain characters and give a bit of a twist to it.
Absolutely.
So for me, I remember too, this was Todd, the novice writer, right? Which some of the critics came in and went, "It's terrible writing, Todd." And it was like, yeah, it's my first few issues. I've never written before. I mean, people could separate Todd, the polished artist who'd been in the business for years and was winning awards, from Todd, the novice writer who'd never written a book in his entire lifetime. So they assume that Todd, the writer, always should have been as good as Todd, the artist, even though, as I mentioned earlier in the conversation, it takes days and hours to get those skills. Like, well, why would I be a professional writer on day one? It didn't make any sense. But more importantly, visually, I just wanted to be able to walk away when I was done with that story and say, did you feel like that I put Doc Connors in a light that you had never seen before? Good, bad, or different, I'll put that up to you, the reader. But did you at least feel like I put him in a different light? And if the answer was yes, then whether it was better or worse should be long for another conversation. That I thought I sort of accomplished my job at that point.
Absolutely. I can remember being handed a tattered copy of the trade of Torment, and that was my first real introduction to your artwork and to your writing, and still to this day, I mean, that's a story that I love to read and that I'm happy that I can push on to my kids and say, here is a great Spider-Man story. You don't need to know nothing else. Just read this. And that even goes farther into Spawn with your writing, too, because that, I think, was a major selling point, at least for me, when I started reading in high school. The artwork was great. It was your artwork. But the story was so involved, and it was so deep, and it was so, it seemed so thought out and put together, you know, that it wasn't going to be the typical single-issue storyline, and then next issue it's going to be something else. No, you had to be invested in this, and you had to read this, and it benefited, and it worked out.
Well, you know, to be perfectly honest, when I first started out doing the Spawn, you know, if somebody was to say explain Spawn to me, it probably would have been about a 10-minute conversation, right? But as time goes by, you then start adding layers your character, and you start adding pieces to it, mm-hmm. so that then, you know, 2 years later, I would, you know, I could have, that conversation could have lasted, you know, an hour. Now today, if you ask me, you know, talk to me about Spawn, I can bore you for the day, probably. So again, you know, some of it you are making up on the fly, but as you do that, then you start having these happy accidents of things that make sense, right?
Absolutely.
So, for instance, I'll give you one that sort of goofy, and I don't even remember if I said it in the book, which was the costume being alive, which is now a big component of his mythos, came about because I was drawing pages so fast and out of order, I wasn't really sort of referencing my own artwork, and all of a sudden, you know, it got printed, and somebody said, hey, Todd, you put the leg pack on the left leg, and now it's on the right leg, and how come the chain had 12 lengths and now it's only at 15 lengths or whatever? I mean, and so there was artistic errors there. And instead of being, you know, sort of mature enough to say, I just screwed up, I basically went, because the costume's alive. Yeah, that's it. The costume is alive and it's constantly in flux and it always moves. And so once I sort of BS'd my way through that answer, then I have to actually then make that legit. And
yeah.
That's part of the mythos here, which actually sort of works in terms of, you know, how the cape can now be sort of long and short and snap around and the chains can sort of move around and whatever else. So, but once you now say you've got a component, you've got a live costume on, then gets into where did the costume come from, what's the sort of origin of the costume, and you build, again, another whole layer on top of it. It just helps to expand your character that much more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, taking it even a step farther, Spawn, at this point, has become successful. You are successful both commercially in Marvel and DC and independently with Image Comics. Now comes the next logical step, which is toys. But as you say in your biography, everybody else just wasn't doing it the way that you wanted it done, so you did it yourself, and that became the creation of McFarlane Toys. And anybody who's listening to this podcast no doubt has at least one action figure from your toy line. So let's talk about the creation of McFarlane Toys. How did that come about?
In its simplest form, I wanted to come out and it reached the top of the chart. And because of that, then you have a lot of people around the country that will then look at charts and say, hey, there's something that's number one, go get a license. So the toy guys came out, and so did other people. People, you know, do like pajamas and bedspreads and, you know, all goofy stuff. And they all came and they said, hey, you know, because they were looking at the charts and saying it's above X-Men, it's above Superman, it's above Batman, it's above Spider-Man. So they just sort of assumed it was all the same thing. And then, you know, they come and they say, hey, we want to make pajamas of Spawn. And I go, have you actually read the book? And they're like, oh, not thoroughly, but you know, we've seen it. And I go, so I knew they would be looking at charts. And I go, well, do yourself a favor, go and read the book. And I don't know if you want to do Pit of Hell pajamas, but it's sort of kind of cool. It could be kind of rad. and a bunch of them never came back, obviously, because it wasn't suitable for what it was they were trying to license.
Right.
But you know, toys was one that they sort of went, okay, cool, not a big deal. But what I found, and I dealt with all of them, I dealt with all the big companies, all public companies. I felt that they were going to take sort of the standard approach, and make the standard toy, and sell it in the standard way, and put it right next to like their Disney product and their Teletubby products and stuff. So, and then I felt that wasn't going to work, and then they would hand it back to me, that basically be damaged goods, saying, here, you can have your license back, it doesn't work. And it would be a long time before I'd ever be able to put toys in the marketplace again, because all of a sudden there'd be that stain that would be on it from not selling the way they did it. So, after about the fifth guy came, and I could just see it was just repetition of what they wanted to do. I just got fed up a little bit. I just want, you know, what did it take to make plastic goods? It's more complicated than making printed pictures, which is comic books. Not really complicated, I got to tell you. You know, draw it, take it to the printer, and they'll print it. And, oh, by the way, my dad had been in the printing business for 40 years, so we had that angle down. You know, so making plastic goods was not a big deal. I wasn't trying to build a nuclear plant. So I made a couple phone calls, found a couple people that had been in the toy business, and we put a band of us together, and bang, we made some goofy toys that came out of the gate. I got lucky to put some orders in, bought our first wave of them, and we literally haven't looked back since. But just like my book of art, if you look at those first few toys that actually were winning awards, which is sort of silly, and look at the skill level that we were able to do 10 years later, again, there's no comparison, right? We learned this of toy making, and we got better and better and better to the point where we actually did. I remember one where we actually did Spawn through the years. We did like the first one, and then one years later, and one 8 years after that. And you can see the progression of how much better we got at toy making. So, you know, we've been fortunate enough now that besides Spawn, we've got a bunch of other lights that have been able to stay in business for 20 years.
Absolutely. And that takes us to where we are now. What is in store for Spawn? What can we expect in the future?
Obviously, the comic book is still going to come out on a steady basis. The new artist I put on the book with 201 is just getting warmed up. And, you know, he just finished issue 229. I'm writing 226. So between him and I, we've now done, you know, we're hoping to do at least 50 issues in a row together. I don't know the last time that anybody can say that's happened, the same writer-artist team for 50 issues.
Not many people.
It used to happen. Remember Stan Lee, Jack Kirby?
Yeah,
and stuff. Yeah. So again, like I said, I don't want to renumber my book. I don't want to start it over at number one. I don't want to have 25 artists and 35 issues. I'm sort of old school. I want a book that someday's up to issues 500, and you know, if I have just one artist, you know, the whole time, I'd love it. You know, because at least there's a consistency that you can then sell to the consumer. I'm also starting to ramp up the animation again, trying to get that with some inertia. But what's going to kickstart that is going to be that I just need to finish the script, and I'm about halfway through on the movie. There will be a R-rated dark drama with not a lot of special effects. It just could be a scary-ass movie.
That's what Spawn needs to be right there, is a scary movie.
No villains. Yeah, it's just going to be a ghost story. It's like it's more like a ghost story. And if I get that off the ground, then I think that will work, and it'll be successful enough. It will trigger then people then going, oh, yeah, now I need that animation. I'll be able to put that back on the market in a second after that. And then the toys will come back out, and all the things will just follow from the success of it. So I've got an Academy Award-winning actor that's just waiting for me to finish that script, because he says, I'm in, Todd. So, and once I get it done, we'll fund it in about 4.5 seconds. The deal is that I write, produce, direct, which is why it's taken so long, because I gotta get that script done, and the only person that's been slowing that down is Todd. And then I'll once we get it all polished up and going, then I'll direct it, because I've had it in my brain for so long now. I've been sitting on this idea for 10 years that I don't want to explain it to somebody else. I'll just direct it myself. And the only way anybody's gonna let me direct the full length movie is if I keep the budget reasonable. And so I had to come up with a story years ago that was gonna be low budget, quote unquote, that would then allow them to put sort of the novice director Todd McFarlane in the seat.
And if your track record says anything, I mean, it's that when you set out to do it yourself, it becomes success. I mean, that goes with your writing with Spider-Man, and then with Spawn and the toy company, and now with this movie. And even with that, I mean, to keep it a low budget film, that's what a lot of people are interested in now, is the gritty, the dark, the handheld motion type movies, and nowadays more than anything else, that is an immediate possibility.
Well, I'm hoping. I've got two daughters, two oldest are female. And you know, they were always bugging me, how come you don't make nothing for our dad? It's always monsters and silly stuff. But as they got older, they ended up, you know, always, I was seeing like every weekend they were going out to movies, and one of the movies that they would go to a lot with their friends were these sort of scary movies, right? And they like to like get together and jump and scream and be spooked, you know, even if it's just stuff like Red Eye, you know?
Yeah.
You know, anything that gets their heart pumped. And so to me, you know, I go, how am I ever going to do a Spawn movie and get my daughter to actually go to it, beside it, you know, they share my DNA, and the answer was that I was going to have to do something that made sense to my fans and would make sense to moviegoers in a general sense, and moviegoers will go to spooky movies, and I go, so I'm just going to make a spooky movie, like, you know, again, you know, and I told people, what if in the movie The Departed there was something moving in the shadows every now and then. So it's, you know, it's a real movie, you know, our drama movie that now just happens to have this one element of supernatural, which is the thing that you and I intellectually know as Spawn. But not any ray guns, not any fights with supervillains, none of that. None of the normal trappings of a traditional action superhero comic book or movie, but more along the lines of you know, of The Grudge, or The Ring or something like that. It just sort of like, whoa, what the hell was that?
Now, for those of us that are listening right now, if we know anything about you, is we know that you love baseball. But I have a question here from one of our members on Stash My Comics, Two Guns 365. He's curious about one thing. You have a lot of prized and valuable baseballs in your collection, but what is your most prized and valuable comic book?
Action Comics number one.
that's a good answer. on top of that, also, looking back at Spawn, would you have changed anything to make it different? Or did you have anybody else in mind to play Spawn other than Michael J. White?
I mean, the movie?
Yes, the first one.
Yeah. I would have. We sort of rushed some of the special effects near the end, some of the house stuff. I would have edited or figured out how not to get there. It I didn't think it sort of played as. I mean, when you see stuff now in movies, you know, where they can do lava and how, I mean, it's just crazy what they can do now. We weren't there yet with the technology, and we tried to shoehorn it. I thought it sort of jolted you out of, like, the movie you were watching. And then I would have also edited out, you know, more of that little kid that was in there and the dog. Again,
right.
To me, but that was just them trying to do PG-13 stuff. And I get it. I know why they did it, but, you know, to me, I've always had sort of an R-rated, you know, drama mine. Whenever I look at movies, those have always been my favorite movies. And not again, our drama. I didn't think that we sort of struck that chord. But again, they weren't. The studio wasn't going for it. They were going for a PG-13 rating. But what was encouraging, I remember, is that the weekend it came out, and we hit $20 million opening, which is, you know, close to 30 now in today's dollars, is that they said that 75% of the people who went, and that was in whenever the movie came out, were 14 or older. And I remember when they gave me that stat, it told me that if I just sort of hold on long enough, that everybody basically then will be over 21 and they can all go to R-rated movies, right? And so then we can just turbo this thing up and make it as badass as we need to make it and not be concerned that we're not going to get the same audience because they're all going to be old enough to go. So I think if I make something that's just cool, dark, and scary and just, you know, just bizarre, people will look at it and go, wow, dude, that's awesome, that trailer. And then all of a sudden the word Spawn comes up, and they go, and that's Spawn? Wow, I was going to go through it, and I didn't even see the word. I just thought it was sort of creepy. Then I think I should be able to get, portions of the new audience, but then I think there'll still be a curiosity factor from those people who saw the first one to see what it is that the new one's doing, and there's no reason why we couldn't do as well, if not exceed financially what we did on that first movie, especially given that, you know, the average ticket price is $10, and back then it was about $6.50.
Yeah, it's gone up significantly between now and then. But one more question for you before I let you go. This one's from Jason Newcomb. He's one of our moderators on Stash My Comics. He wants to ask kind of a personal question, and I know we touched on this a little bit throughout the course of the interview, but Jason says that what he's most impressed with when it comes to you is your business acumen. What do you feel has been the key skill that has allowed you to achieve your dreams?
Some of it isn't stuff that I encourage, you know, just pure stubbornness and a lot of immaturity at times. And that gets me to sort of be sort of tunnel vision. I went to school and played Pac-10 baseball in college.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sort of trained as an athlete to sort of focus on the moment. And as a baseball player, all you want to do is hit the baseball. There are plenty of times I didn't even know the color of the hair of the pitcher. I was that focused on the ball. I could play an entire game, and if somebody said he was blonde or brown hair, I had no idea. And so there's some of that component that came into it. But then probably superseding all of that is just the mere fact that if I want to get my artwork out the way that I see fit, and I didn't see any avenues that could get me to where I wanted to, and I'm not saying that the direction I wanted to go was the right one, but it was right for me personally, then there's only one way to do it, and just do it yourself. So I've never been a guy who really bitches a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a water cooler guy. I just like, this town I live in is too hot. Then move, right? My girlfriend, then dump her. My boss, I don't like them. Can quit your job. To me, like a lot of things that we sort of lament about, they're curable, right?
Absolutely.
People call me a drunk. Then put down the alcohol. This is like, these are all within our grasp. There are not a lot of things, I don't think, you know, that are kind of out of our grasp in big picture stuff. So to me, I was like, okay, I want to get my artwork out. If I want to get my artwork out, nobody will create the delivery mechanism the way that I see fit. I guess I'll have to do it myself. The downside is it takes away every day, every moment you're spending time learning the new language of business, you're not doing artwork, right? But if you don't get fluent in that language, you are not going to be very successful at it. So it was a balancing act. And as you know, I think there's a great book that could be written about, you know, what happened to the seven original founders of Image. Where did they go? And we all sort of took a different path to wherever we went, because each of us either succeeded or or didn't at different rates in all directions, and none of us sort of repeated the same path that the other guy did. So why did my business decisions turn out a little bit better than some of my partners in the past? I don't know. I never asked them. I was just making decisions for myself at that point.
Absolutely. Jim Lee is now at D.C. Rob Liefeld just left D.C. Silvestri is still going strong with Top Cow. I mean, Cyberforce number one just came out. But, you know, and then we have you, and you are as successful.
Oh, and again, take Robert Kirkman, again, a new addition. He's a writer, first writer partner, and he blows up with Walking Dead on top of it. So, you know, and again, Robert Kirkman, just to digress, is a huge example. People go, well, it can't be like Todd, because the marketplace isn't the same as it was when you and Jim Lee were doing it, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, to forget about us. Take a look at Robert Kirkman. But the reason Robert Kirkman was able to find that success, because he at least made the attempt. He at least, just like sending out my original samples to people to get rejected, and they can't reject you if they don't even ever see it. So you're never going to sell something, and you're never going to get a job as an actor if you don't go for an audition. So you got to, at some point, you got to get thick skin. And like I said, when I quit Spider-Man, if you wanted any Todd McFarlane artwork, you had to buy this character called Spawn that they knew nothing about. And so I was able to sort of bribe them into buying Spawn, where a lot of writers haven't succeeded in the independent market, because they continue to do their DC and Marvel work while they're doing their independent work, and I think it's a fool's game. And Robert Kirkman figured it out. Drop all my Marvel and DC work and just do Image work, so they have to buy my independent work. Right, ding, 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 ding. That's how it works for artists. So it's the recipe that can still work to this day. And I'm quite proud that, you know, really my one of my biggest, the proudest thing is that 20 years later, 20 plus years later, Image exists, and not only does it exists in a healthy fashion, and more so, the healthiness of it is not even predicated any longer on the books that the founders do, the original founders. Wildcats isn't there, you know, Spawn does okay, Dragon does okay, there is no Youngblood, there is, you know, Shadowhawk and some of the original, none of that's there, but Image still is thriving. And that, to me, is sort of my, one of the things that I got the biggest smile on my face at, like being a proud papa, you know, watching all these young kids come up doing well for themselves. And it's like, go get them, Robert. Go get them, right? Like, God bless you. I hope you have 10 times the success I ever had.
And that's what it's all about. And Image is a prime example of that. Todd, I want to thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us at Stash My Comics for this interview. It has been an experience and something on my bucket list to get to talk to you at least one time. But the book is called Todd McFarlane. The title is The Devil's in the Details. It comes out November 21st. It's 400-plus pages. You guys need to check this out. It's a fantastic book. It talks about McFarlane's journey from where he started to where he is today. It's something that any aspiring artist, or even writer for that matter, needs to have in their collection. Mr. McFarlane, is there anything else you'd like to add before we end?
No, like I said, I've been very fortunate and been able to make a living doing sort of childish things, right? You know, so I pinch myself whenever I have a bad day, and there are plenty of them, that I remind myself that I could be digging a ditch and doing, you know, far worse. So I don't usually bellyache too much. You know, I've had fair amount of critics over the years, but I think if somebody was to literally take all my interviews and reread every one of them, about 97% of what I say is about me. I just talk about my life, you know, and why I quit this, why I did this, and why I did. I don't really sort of lament too much about why Jim Lee did anything, right?
Right.
I leave that up to Jim. And, oh, by the way, you know, go ask Jim. So, but I know I did what I did, and so. I think there's a confusion sometimes that somehow I try to hold people down or say to people, even things like, don't work for Marvel. I've never said that. I have never, ever said that to another person. I've said it. Yeah, good luck. I hope you get in. It's cool. They got lots of good character. I'm just saying, me personally, I can't do it anymore. No big deal. You know, again, it's not a put down. I had a great experience at Marvel and DC. Got lots of friends. Enjoyed. Was able to sort of increase my skill level. Got to draw some cool characters. But for me now, where I'm at in my life, you know, Marvel and DC, because people always ask me to go back. I'd say no. And it's not because of any negativity. It's because Marvel and DC are in my past. So, and my, you know, it's like high school to me. I had a great time in high school. Lots of friends. Enjoyed my time. Don't plan on going back to high school either. So it's just part of the journey. The journey's in front. But yeah, anybody out there that wants to break into comic books, you don't get to be a beggar. Anybody gives you any book, anytime, anywhere, with any character, you grab it and run. Get your foot in the door, get in the game, get in the industry, and who knows what will come of it, because I was a kid. I started at a low-level book, at low-level pay, with terrible artwork, and I was somehow able to trip over some good fortune, and I bet you there's somebody listening today that could be the next cut.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Once again, the book is Todd McFarlane, The Devil's in the Details. It comes out November 21st. Todd, thank you very much for joining us at Stash My Comics today.
All right. You be good.
I will. Thank you. StashMyComics.com, powered by Geek Energy. Okay.
Wow, that's something else.
Right? Wasn't that such a good interview?
My goodness, yeah. When he said he was the original body model for the Incredible Hulk, that's amazing.
What?
It was a weird hurricane.
I guess. So this is the end of the episode. That interview was long, but it was good. I mean, You can tell in the beginning that I was kind of intimidated, but I also had a lot of caffeine too, so that had a small part to play. But
I wish you would ask him. I wish you would ask him about Zelda, X-Force, Spider-Man froze over the last page. Peter Spider-Man with five fingers.
You know, that's funny you mentioned that, because in the visual biography, he talks about like he shows the panel that made him say that he was done with Marvel, and it was in that issue of Spider-Man. Like, yeah, where Juggernaut gets stabbed in the eye by Shatterstar's sword or something like that, and he had to rework that so many times, and he was just tired of it. He's like,
cool, very cool, man.
Yeah, so that's what it is. I hope you guys enjoyed the interview. I enjoyed doing the interview. Tom, I wish you could have been there. It would have been really great to have you alongside to ask him some questions. But maybe next time. Maybe next time we'll get Jim Valentino and we can talk Guardians of the Galaxy. Ladies and gentlemen, do not forget to hit up our merchandise store, Zazzle.com/StashMyComics, ZAZZLE.com. You can get bumper stickers, you can get hats, t-shirts, anything you want with the SMC logo on it. You know you have to have that, so just go ahead and do it. Let us know what you get so that way we can compare. Also, don't forget to check out the Dollar Box this month. It's Sincerely the Sandman. It's great stuff. Paul O'Connor from Longbox Graveyard. Every month he brings out a column called The Dollar Box. You guys need to take a look at it. It's really good stuff. Also, don't forget crowdfunding Flash. Chip's got something new for us every Wednesday, so you guys need to keep an eye open for that. Lots of great independent stuff to take a look at. Cyberforce number 1 got funded through that, so you get the first 5 issues for free because of the Kickstarter. The Goon animated movie is going through a Kickstarter right now. You can find that on StashMyComics.com. Also, don't forget Leo Johnson, one of our reviewers right now. He's got Storm Dogs, the review from Image Comics, up there right now. You need to take a look at that. That seems like a really good read. Ape for Comics podcast, Matt and Neil, those guys are great. they do strictly comic books. They don't deviate from that course, and it's awesome to listen to. You guys really need to take a look at that stuff. It's a really hot podcast right now, so you guys really need to listen to that. Also, Tom's Geek Cinema. Tom, what do you have in store for us for the next Geek Cinema?
Well, I'm going to get to my wife's man. It wasn't on the list of top 10 movies of all time. I had to put that on the list so I could do the Lucasfilm Star Wars article. After that, I'm probably going to do some TV reviews. I don't know if you guys have caught the new Ninja Turtles on Nickelodeon.
I've
talked about that. We'll talk about that. I think that's an excellent show. Also, Arrow on WWE. We're going to talk about that a little bit.
Arrow. I love that show. Deathstroke has been in it. Deadshot has been in it. Huntress is going to be in a two-parter episode that should have already come out by the time this podcast. So I'm all about Arrow. That's
maybe also talking about Bad Revolution.
Also, don't forget Tommy Lutz. He does comics for noobs for us. If you don't know where to go to pick up some good comic books, Tommy can steer you in the right direction. Take a look at what he has to say. He hasn't been wrong so far. I mean, what he says is good usually turns out to be good, and what he says is crap pretty much is. Video game reviews, Scott Shea, he's got Arkham City up right now. He's got some new stuff coming out, so keep an eye out for that. Also, with the Marvel Now stuff, if you still don't know or unsure about where to go with that, take a look at the review I did of Marvel Now Point 1. That's pretty informative, kind of give you a good idea on what to do. Also, don't forget, hit us up on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes. You guys know what to do. Tom, Jason, you got anything else?
I think I'm going to buy the Bendis X-Men book.
What?
Yeah, the Bendis X-Men Marvel Now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's doing the X-Men, the old X-Men travel for time.
Oh,
all
X-Men.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
that one.
How? I don't know.
I am going to buy that.
It's interesting. What's intrigued me the most is the Guardians of the Galaxy storyline and Ant-Man.
Right up.
Yeah. Right up. Those have my attention.
All right, cool.
Okay, well, if there's nothing else, ladies and gentlemen, we are out of here.
1, 2, 3. SlashMyComics.com is the leading free online interactive comic book database. Catalog your comics and track prices, character, and creator appearances. Follow the daily blog reviews, editorials, and a weekly podcast. Connect with other fans through member reviews and discussion forums. Keep abreast of site updates on Twitter at StashMyComics and find us on Facebook. StashMyComics.com, powered by Geek Energy.
Nailed it.